the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, events, and issues that matter to you. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, we're going to take a look at the Salt Lake County landfill and answer some of the common questions that get asked about what happens with the things that we throw away.
So currently, the EPA estimates that every person in the United States throws away about 5.5 pounds of garbage per day. So that's 5 pounds per person per day. So it's not hard to see why our landfill takes in 3 million pounds of garbage per day.
KCBW's Ross Chambliss speaks with Ashley Yoder, Recycling Program Coordinator for Salt Lake County. That and your local headlines coming up on The Rundown. First, though, these messages and access downtown. And welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. A little bit later on the show, a conversation about the landfill and recycling. First up, we have these headlines. Utah energy officials say a newly released federal plan to cut pollution blamed for global warming is aggressive and that it's too preliminary to tell if the plan is doable. Environmental advocates are cheering the rule released Monday by the Obama administration, saying it could spur alternative energy development. The rule would curb national carbon dioxide emissions from power plants by almost a third over the next decade and a half. It would require Utah, which relies on coal for about 80% of its electricity, to cut emissions by nearly as much. The federal rule tailors specific goals for each state, and it is up to governors to submit a plan to meet the federal standard by 2017. If governors forego making a proposal, the EPA may impose its own regulations. On Friday, the Bureau of Land Management and Utah State University signed an agreement to share research on air quality in the Uinta Basin. Utah Public Radio reporter Jennifer Pemberton traveled to Vernal to see how this agreement might make life easier for researchers trying to understand the mystery of wintertime ozone in the rural West.
Ozone is associated with summer air pollution in populated places. Today, in northeastern Utah, even within the city limits of Vernal, the air is clean. It's breezy, and Seth Lyman, an air quality expert with Utah State University, is explaining why almost everything here is backwards.
We have never had ozone exceedances in the summer unless there's really strong wildfire influence.
Cities all along the Wasatch Front watch for unhealthy levels of ozone cooking over hot asphalt in the heat of the day. But the Uinta Basin has spikes of unhealthy levels of ozone on the coldest days of winter.
It really, and I think more strongly than in Logan or Salt Lake, depends on snow cover. If we have adequate snow cover, then we get the inversions, and when the inversions are here, we're almost for certain going to have air quality issues. And when
there's an apocryphal story of an ozone monitor in Sublette County, Wyoming, that got left on all winter, and when the workers checked it in the spring, it had recorded levels of ozone that no one thought could happen in winter or in a rural area. Within a few years, the EPA started monitoring ozone in the rural West, where oil and gas development is happening, including the Uinta Basin, and they found that the Wyoming monitor wasn't a fluke. Winter ozone really is a thing. No one can deny the correlation between oil and gas development and the formation of winter ozone. But the complex chemistry that takes the precursor emissions from gas and oil wells and transforms them into harmful ozone hasn't been fully explained, nor have the meteorological conditions that make this a wintertime problem. Mike McKee is the Uinta County Commissioner.
We've recognized the importance of the extractive industry. We also recognize the importance of having good, clean, safe air, and we believe that we can have both.
The Utah Office of the Bureau of Land Management issues the most permits of any state for new drill sites. It's clear that the goal for the state is to have its energy extraction and its clean air, too.
The Uinta Basin is really critical to the BLM as it relates to oil and gas. We want to continue to keep that focus, but in order for us to continue to keep that focus of permits to drill, we need to be able to address air quality.
Juan Palma is the director of the BLM in Utah. He's one of the signatories of a memorandum of understanding that would share the federal agency's research with Utah State University's Bingham Research Center in Vernal. Rob Bahunin, vice president for advancement and commercialization at USU, signed for the university.
Adding to the practical and very pragmatic approach of helping a community, an industry, that's part of our land grant mission of Utah State. That's what we're charged to do and have been charged to do since we were chartered back in 1888.
What USU is being given is a modeling platform developed by the BLM, 4 years and $1 million in the making. Leonard Hare is the BLM's air resource specialist in Utah.
It's like we're buying a Ferrari and then we're using it to drive down to the market every day. You know, we're not really using these models to their best potential. We expect USU to actually do that. We're giving them the keys to Ferrari and we want to see them roaring up and down the highway with this thing. You know, using these models to actually do planning level analysis that then BLM can look at and tier to in our documents and make reasoned management decisions off of.
The hope is that this expensive modeling equipment and this collaboration will be a blueprint for air quality management for federally managed lands throughout the West dealing with similar problems.
EPA is looking at lowering this ozone standard. If you look at a map of the potential non-attainment areas from this lowered ozone standard, we're going to see huge areas of the West that are declared non-attainment by EPA, and there is no existing methodology, Clean Air Act requirements, anything that addresses how to deal with that. And the way to deal with that is collaboratively, multi-jurisdictionally. We need everybody at the table, the feds, the states, the tribal governments, because we all contribute, we're all affected by it, and we're not going to solve it unless we, you know, come together to solve it.
The BLM can't do this on its own. USU can't do this on its own. No one can. The idea is that putting a bunch of heads together can result in an innovative answer to a multi-pronged question, the gist of which still eludes almost everyone at the table. For KCPW News, I'm Jennifer Pemberton.
Now on the program, we turn to a conversation between KCPW producer Ross Chambliss and Salt Lake County Recycling Program Manager Ashley Yoder about the lifespan of the Salt Lake County landfill, about local recycling efforts, and many of the common questions surrounding what happens with the stuff that we discard.
Landfills are designed to hold waste for, well, forever. And if not properly managed, they can seep methane gas into the atmosphere and toxic leachate into groundwater. In addition to environmental considerations, there are also economic ones. The Salt Lake Valley has two landfills. Once these landfills have reached maximum capacity and are permanently closed, county officials say waste haulers will likely be required to transport waste outside of Salt Lake County at a greater expense to residents. To better understand landfill management, as well as how to prolong our landfills' lifespans, I am joined today by Ashley Yoder, Program Manager for Salt Lake Valley Recycling. Ashley, thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Your office's primary stated function is to prolong the life of the Salt Lake Valley's landfills. Can you tell me why and how is the county trying to do this?
Well, one of the first and probably more obvious ways to preserve the life of the landfill is to keep things out of it that don't need to be there. That seems relatively simple, and that's kind of our mission, is to pay attention to the things that could be recycled and could have a better life somewhere else. Anything that goes into our landfill stays there. We do not sort. We do not salvage. All of that has to come from our customers. Our residents need to be able to take responsibility for sorting those materials that we think could be recycled or better used otherwise.
Hmm. Would you be able to explain or share what is the municipal waste disposal rate per person in Utah, or specifically Salt Lake County, if you know? And also, how does this figure compare to historical figures in Salt Lake County?
Historically, residents are disposing of more and more waste every year. Now, we're trying to divert some of that waste and calling it material and creating a green waste program, creating recycling programs. But at the end of the day, all of that is considered waste. All of that is what we no longer use. And that rate has continued to climb. So currently, the EPA estimates that every person in the United States throws away about 5.5 pounds of garbage per day. So that's 5 pounds per person per day. So it's not hard to see why our landfill takes in 3 million pounds of garbage per day.
Looking at the two landfills here, if we follow current recycling rates and, I suppose, projected population increases, how long until it is expected our landfills will reach capacity?
Well, our Salt Lake County landfill is estimated to last until the year 2065. Now, at first, that sounds like a pretty long time, until we realize that our two nearest landfills, one in Davis County and one in West Jordan, are slated to close in somewhere between 18 and 20 years. When their life is over, the waste that is currently going to them will most likely come to us. That would shorten our lifespan significantly.
Certainly. Now, last September, in September 2013, Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams called for residents to increase how much they recycle in 2 years to help the county improve its overall recycling percentage, which I gather was somewhere around just 16%. And I understand the national average for recycled household solid waste materials is roughly 36%. So it's been about 9 months. Has the county seen a change in recycling rates?
I always like to mention that 20% challenge in at every opportunity. This challenge was issued to our residents to remind residents that we do have the ability to recycle, and there are a lot of materials that maybe get passed over in our recycling day to day. The 20% challenge was intended to ask our residences and our businesses to look at ways they could find additional recycling opportunities. And we think that's happening. We are interacting with more and more residents all the time that want to participate in the challenge. And we're having a lot of success in our social media outreach. And we've had over 200 residents take a pledge to increase their recycling by 20%. And that number goes up every day.
That's good to hear. Why would you say, why don't more Salt Lake County residents recycle their household waste as much as perhaps other places in the country?
Well, I really think that it has a lot to do with just habits. We have habits in how we dispose of our materials. When you go to work, you generally will dispose of your materials the same way every day over time. The same is true at home. The same is true when you go camping, or if you go to a friend's house for a barbecue. Typically, there are patterns for disposing of our waste or our materials. And changing those patterns is harder than it sounds. So the initial step is to ask residents to think about that. Think about, are there patterns you could change? Could you find ways to recycle more just by changing a habit here and there?
So it's really kind of a behavioral learned activity.
It is. We find that waste disposal is by habit.
That's really interesting. Well, I kind of want to move, related to that, to asking a few questions about recycling bin contamination. So first, beginning at the residential street collection phase, I understand that contamination poses an ongoing problem for our single stream recycling system where materials are co-mingled together in the same blue bins. This can happen when residents put food or food containers or grease in the wrong bins that can potentially spoil the whole batch downstream. Could you talk about how contaminants can impact the recycling process and what can be done about it?
Well, contamination rates have gone up. I would like to paint a rosy picture, but in an effort to really be truthful here, contamination rates are going up along with recycling rates. So that's something that we take pretty seriously in our education efforts. And I think a lot of that has to do with a lack of education. Now, the impact of that contamination is felt through many businesses that handle recycling. So recycling is an industry. It is a business that supports jobs, that supports taxes. However, the contamination rate takes away some of the profit in those businesses and makes it difficult for those businesses to survive if they're taking in this material, processing it, and then having to pay to landfill it. So we want to protect those recycling businesses. We want them to stay in business. We want to provide them with the best product we can. And that's how we support those businesses. And supporting recycling businesses takes pollution out of our air, pollution out of our water, and reduces our draw on natural resources. This is something that is going to become more and more important as our population grows. As you mentioned before, our population is growing. As our population grows, we want to be more concerned with protecting our environment, including air and water and resources.
It really is a kind of a perplexing problem, because you might have a household or a group of households who are really doing their best to sort everything out and recycle properly, but you might have just that one household who really hasn't gotten it yet and is contaminating and potentially contaminating the whole batch once it gets all mixed together when it gets trucked away, right? So it really is a community issue.
Oh, it definitely is. And neighbors helping neighbors is always a valuable asset. That's a good way to go about creating a better community.
Sure. Well, so next, I understand it's not possible, perhaps, to stop all contaminants from getting into landfills, but could you talk about how landfill managers contain or treat many of these contaminants? So, for example, could you describe how the county protects groundwater or surface water from contaminants such as the leachate, the water with dissolved contaminants that slips down through the trash?
Okay. We consider, at landfills, we consider a couple of materials to be particularly difficult to handle. And one of them that you are mentioning has to do with chemicals. Chemicals can contaminate groundwater as well as our air. So we've got watershed and airshed that we are required to monitor and basically take care of. So we test our leachate, and we actually do an air quality monitoring fairly frequently. In addition to that, we're regulated by the health department and the EPA. So all of those regulators come out to check and see how we're doing on things. And some of the things that we dispose of that other landfills cannot are some of those difficult to handle things, like asbestos disposal. That's a pretty difficult material to handle, but we're able to handle it because of the safeguards we have in place. We protect our water, and no water leaves our landfill unless it's clean.
And so I'm just curious, how is that by design, or originally when the landfill was constructed, or how are you able to make it so that the leachate actually can't leave the premises?
It has to do with the design. The design of a Subtitle D landfill, which is what we have in Salt Lake County, is the most highly regulated and the most often inspected landfill. So we are subject to many regulations from many different entities. We're in charge of, or we're charged with, providing a system to contain those pollutants. And a lot of that has to do with the design. Our landfill is on a clay lake bed. And so on top of that clay lake bed, we have a plastic liner. And that's a trademark of a Subtitle D landfill, is a plastic liner. So this plastic liner goes on top of that. And then on top of that layer is what we call the leachate collection system. And this would be sand or gravel. In our case, it's gravel. The layer of gravel, then perforated pipes on top of that, then more gravel, then a geosynthetic liner that protects that leachate collection system from getting clogged up with dirt. Then on top of that, we have a layer of dirt, and that's all before we put one bit of garbage on it. And then we start adding garbage to it. That leachate system collects all the water that runs through the garbage, but it does not get past that liner. That plastic liner will not go away. It keeps all that water in. So further evidence that plastic does not degrade in a landfill, because we line the landfill with it.
That's a really a good point. And I definitely want to get to plastic and talk about that a little bit. Just to back up slightly, can you remind our listeners, because we didn't bring it up, when the Salt Lake Valley County landfill was actually created?
Yeah, we started using our current landfill in 1991/2.
Okay, so it's a little over 20 years old. Okay.
Right.
I want to talk some more about some specific materials that cause problems for our landfills. Interestingly, mattresses seem to be of particular concern. Could you tell us about the problem of old mattresses in Utah?
It's interesting you bring that up, because I'm known as the world's largest advocate for mattress recycling. And the reason for that is mattresses take up an enormous amount of space in our landfill. They act like sponges and do not compact, and actually pose a safety risk for our operators that have to try to handle this material. So all the way around, mattresses in a landfill are a bad deal. A mattress does not compact. All the rest of the waste that we bring into the landfill, we compact as much as we possibly can, because again, we're talking about space. A landfill is all about space, not about tons, but volume. Well, mattresses are a large volume item, along with some other bulky waste like couches and chairs. So I have been an advocate for a long time of mattress recycling, and it works in other communities. We are really fortunate that a mattress recycler has just moved here and is going to start accepting materials. Personally, I can't wait until I can send a bunch of mattresses over to him instead of our landfill. But there's a cost to those things. It costs us an enormous amount of money to landfill a mattress. It's also going to cost us some money to recycle them. But I look at that as that's where we are. We're taking responsibility for our waste.
So, and I guess you mentioned a company that emerged. Are you able to talk a little more about that? Or is this is something that's really kind of just starting, right?
It's just starting. He just moved here. He is with a national organization who has set up recycling facilities in many other communities. So I have a lot of confidence that he'll be around for a while. And I think I've looked at his business model. I think that he's got some pretty sound ideas. Okay. So I don't have a problem announcing that he's here, because I think he'll stay for a while.
Okay. And just for the record, so you're referring to Springback Utah Recycling,
mm-hmm.
the company. And then I understand they haven't quite opened yet, but they are possibly already accepting mattresses for recycling.
I hope. I know that he has leased property, and it's near us at the landfill. And he reached out to me just the other day to say, we're here. So I'm very excited.
And so how do you think such a partnership might work? Would it be a case where mattresses get dropped off at a location at the landfill and then they pick it up? Or would their location be located near the landfill, something like that?
They are near the landfill, because Salt Lake County has a sincere commitment to recycling. And that includes difficult to recycle items like mattresses. So in that vein, to keep our commitment, we will transport mattresses to him. We'll collect them from our residents for a fee, and then we will transport them to the recycler and pay the fee to recycle them.
Okay, well, that's good to hear. So this leads me to another question, which is how recycling might benefit the economy. Obviously, having a new business in town that is gonna help solve an environmental problem such as old mattresses is good, but it also seems like it could provide job opportunities for people. So could you talk briefly about how recycling businesses can provide more employment opportunities, jobs for the community?
Sure. It's estimated from multiple sources that landfilling 10,000 tons of waste creates one job. Recycling 10,000 tons of material creates four jobs. So that's a pretty big benefit on anybody's scale. And we have many recycling businesses in Salt Lake County, and they do provide many jobs. A couple of our material recycling facilities employ many people. I don't have the numbers exactly, but they employ quite a number of people. One company recently spent $6 million on an expansion. They invest in our community. This is another one of those cases where we talk about buy local. Well, if you recycle locally, that also has the biggest impact. So those businesses end up spending that money in our community rather than taking it outside. So they provide jobs, they spend money in the community, and they provide a service that we need. They protect our landfills. So recycling businesses have multiple benefits. In addition, the Springback company has a model where they employ hard-to-employ folks. So some of these people who might be on state assistance might be able to get off state assistance through gainful employment, as with Springback. So we're excited about that opportunity and that they can provide an additional service to our community.
You've been listening to part one of a two-part conversation between KCPW's Ross Chambliss and Salt Lake County Recycling Program Manager Ashley Yoder. Tune in tomorrow for part two of their conversation. which, among other things, will look at efforts to rein in the use of plastic bags. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back. Thanks again for tuning into The Rundown this afternoon. Our show was produced by Lauren Colucci. Additional help came from Jesse Ellis, Ryan Cunningham, and Mr. Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. We're on the air each weekday at 5 p.m. here on KCPW, but you can also find us on Twitter. Our handle is at @KCPWRundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are coming up next.